Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, there's a debate at the state capitol over new restrictions for SNAP benefits and Medicaid.
And millennials celebrate the return of the Phoenix band, The Format.
But first, Lauren, as you may recall, a couple weeks ago, I reported on this very contentious city council meeting in Surprise.
Right. This was in response to the warehouse that the Department of Homeland Security recently purchased there.
Exactly. Since then, I have been trying to learn more about the property, in particular, what DHS plans to use it for. And last week, there were some significant developments.
All right, let's hear what you found.
We have acquired a pair of documents that offer concrete details about the Department of Homeland Security's plans for the warehouse it recently purchased in Surprise. After weeks of speculation about what the 400,000-square-foot warehouse might be used for, the documents confirm it will be retrofitted as an ICE detention center, potentially housing 7 to 10,000 detainees for months at a time, numbers much higher than previously known. But Surprise Mayor Kevin Sarter says critical questions still have not been answered.
What they plan to do with it, and some of the impacts it's going to have on our city with police, fire, traffic, those types of things.
After news of the warehouse purchase broke, some Surprise residents felt blindsided. At an emotional five-hour city council meeting in early February, over 80 citizens denounced the purchase. They demanded answers about what steps were being taken to keep potential detainees and Surprise residents safe, and what impact the project will have on the city's resources and economy. U.S. Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, U.S. Representative Paul Gosar, and Mayor Sarter sent letters to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem asking for transparency. While Congressman Gosar did not receive a specific reply to his letter, DHS did apparently send him a pair of documents last week containing specifics about possible uses for the warehouse, as well as an economic impact analysis. Gosar's office shared those documents with Mayor Sarter and the Surprise City Council, who shared them with us. The warehouse, according to one of the documents, is part of a broader DHS project called the ICE Detention Reengineering Initiative. Facilities acquired as part of the initiative fall into two categories: regional processing centers, housing an average daily population of 1,000 to 1,500 detainees for average stays of 3 to 7 days, which will serve as staging locations for transfers or removals. And the second category, large-scale detention facilities, which will house 7 to 10,000 detainees for periods averaging less than 60 days. It's not clear from the documents which category the Surprise warehouse falls into. One document suggests a projected bed capacity of 1,500, but the documents refer to the warehouse as both a, quote, detention facility and a, quote, processing site. DHS appears to use Surprise Processing Site as the official name of the building. The reengineering document also states that buildings DHS has purchased as part of their expanded detention effort will, quote, maximize operational efficiency, minimize costs, shorten processing times, and promote the safety, dignity, and respect of all aliens in ICE custody. The warehouse buildout will include food service, clothing, medical care, including emergency services, legal resources, religious spaces, and recreational areas. The document also states that the warehouse was subjected to an engineering review, which resulted in a determination that the warehouse will have, quote, no detrimental effect on the city's power and water resources. It says a National Environmental Policy Act survey was conducted for the warehouse, but the results of the survey are not included. The economic impact analysis document contains more specifics. It states that DHS will spend $150 million to retrofit the warehouse and an additional $180 million to operate it during the first 3 years. According to DHS models, the warehouse will support about 1,300 jobs during construction, almost 500 jobs during each year of its operation, and generate over $16 million in annual tax revenue. Surprise Mayor Sarter said he still hasn't received a direct reply from DHS about the warehouse. But based on his review of the documents, he says he's expecting the warehouse to be used as a regional processing center.
We're anticipating the 1,000 to 1,500 detainees here in the city of Surprise. The size of that building, I don't think would support much more than that.
When asked about the details in the documents, the job estimates, the tax revenue, and the various services DHS says they'll be providing to detainees, Sartor declined to take a position.
That's something that's outside of the control of the city of Surprise. I mean, for me to talk about, the food and all those other things, is not really my expertise or lane as a city. We're mostly focused on making sure that, we can continue to provide for our residents, make sure everybody's safe, make sure that there's no, traffic impacts, and that with this ICE facility, the city can still operate and do all the things that we need to do to make sure that we're providing for our residents.
Sartor repeatedly stressed the need for local firefighters and law enforcement officials to visit the warehouse and make sure their safety concerns are satisfied. He said he's still hoping DHS will provide more details. Sartor and members of the city council are planning to visit Washington in March and have asked for a meeting with DHS officials to address their concerns. They haven't gotten a reply. Regardless of the answers to his questions, Sartor said, the city's options are limited.
Yeah, there's not a ton of recourse. I mean, you look at the Federal Supremacy Clause, and, the federal government doesn't have to comply with our zoning. They don't have to comply with, state laws. And so really, from my perspective, it's about trying to reach out, coordinate, and make sure that we can get ahead of this the best that we can as a city so we can be prepared.
At that five-hour city council meeting earlier this month, many residents said they recognized there's not much the city can do, but called on the mayor to issue a statement or pass a resolution expressing disapproval for the warehouse. Sartor didn't rule that out.
Right now, we're waiting for the response. I think once we get a response, that you will be able to better, kind of assess what we have going on, how that impacts the city, and then take steps from there.
In a separate conversation about the documents, City Councilman Johnny Melton put it more bluntly.
I'm frustrated that I'm in the dark. This thing is not going to reside in a vacuum. Okay, it's in our community. I get it. I can't stop it, but we can ask.
We have sent multiple messages to both DHS and the ICE field office in Phoenix, but have not received a response.
Is Arizona's food assistance program rife with fraud and abuse? Republicans at the state capitol think so, and they want Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs to sign a package of bills they say will fix it. Not only that, but GOP lawmakers say it will protect Arizona from losing out on federal funding that brings the state in line with the federal budget bill passed in Washington last year. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez has been covering it all for our politics desk, and she joins us now in studio to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is a big package of bills. We're talking about 12 bills. Are all kind of aimed mostly, it sounds like, at food assistance, SNAP, Medicaid benefits, things like that. What would they do in general?
In general, we're talking about changing the eligibility requirements to make it a little harder to get onto these programs. And they're trying to weed out, they say, bad actors or people who are just not qualified to be on there, even if it's by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of them are about reporting, like increased reports to the state about how many people are on these lists and what kind of benefits they're using, stuff like that. But then some of them are a little more off topic, I would say. Like one of them is about reporting the immigration status of patients to the Department of Health Services. Mm-hmm. And one of them is about restricting what kind of foods you're allowed to buy. So 12 packs, 12 bills, all along kind of the same lines, and then a few outliers.
A few outliers. A lot of this has to do, at least when it comes to that federal funding we mentioned, with Arizona's so-called like error rate when it comes to these benefit programs. What's that?
Yeah, so in HR1, which was the big federal beautiful budget bill, whatever, they said that states who have an error rate above a certain percentage are going to lose out on federal funding.
Okay.
And that's a serious, threat for Arizona because we're talking about a few hundred million dollars here. And here our error rate is about 8.8%, and we need to have it down to 6 or below to make sure that we hold on to our federal funding.
Okay.
But Republicans want to go above and beyond that in the state of Arizona. Obviously, I mean, they don't want any error rate,
right?
But these bills are aiming to bring it down to like 3%. So stronger and stricter requirements.
What causes the error rate, Cameron? Like, is this all about fraud and abuse, like Republicans say?
It can be fraud and abuse, and there definitely is some fraud and abuse, but it's also underpayments or overpayments. It's basically anything, mistake or fraud, that goes wrong with paying someone on the program.
Okay. This all comes, as we've seen, a pretty big jump in the numbers of people enrolled in these programs, too, and Republicans kind of questioned that yesterday as well.
Right. We have, and Majority Leader Carbone in the House was saying, you know, we are doing great economically in some ways. We're bringing in jobs. We're expanding. We're a pro-business state. Mm-hmm. And yet our money, you know, we're struggling to fund certain things. So where is our money going? And basically saying he doesn't approve of how much we're spending on these programs. And yes, there are some programs like SNAP and DES access programs that have increased pretty significantly over the last few years in terms of enrollment and therefore in terms of cost.
Interesting. Okay. What do Democrats have to say about all this?
They don't like it. The Democrats, I think there are some areas where they're not really fighting it, like reporting requirements. I think everyone is usually in favor of getting more reported information from agencies. Mm-hmm. But the Democrats don't approve of these stricter eligibility requirements in general because they don't want people to be kicked off of the programs that they need to survive, especially when people are struggling with inflation, especially when people are struggling to make ends meet. And they're worried that legitimate users will be impacted because, you know, sometimes if you go too harshly in their view, then that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. And there were, it sounds like, particular concerns about tribal lands in the state, rural parts of the state.
That's right. James Zeta Peshlakai, lawmaker, she is from a rural area, and she brought that up as a potential issue.
And a lot of these people don't have transportation or even computers. So this is, I just totally think this is wrong for all people that are on these reservation land or rural areas in Arizona.
Yeah, so she was talking about one particular bill, which is about work requirements. Mm-hmm. And it says that, you know, if you're on SNAP but you're not working, you have to go to mandatory work trainings and you basically have to be seeking employment even harder. Mm. And she was saying, well, you know, if you live out in really rural Arizona and you have to go to a training center in Flagstaff or something, you're talking about hours. You're talking about finding a way to get there. And that's just not as easy for some folks as for others.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, this is also renewing an age-old debate about restricting what people who get SNAP benefits, those food assistance benefits, can buy. Cameron, you mentioned this idea that one bill would restrict purchases of candy, energy drinks, things like that. This is a debate we've heard before, and Democrats say this is about fundamental issues of freedom.
Well, I don't really understand how it's about fraud, but it is about SNAP. And yes, they're saying, you know, these are not nutritious foods, and we should only be using taxpayer dollars to pay for those. Mm-hmm. Democrats are saying, well, that's really condescending of you. And also it restricts things like hot foods, prepared foods, you know, mm-hmm. like a rotisserie chicken or something like that at the grocery store. Democrats are arguing, well, you know, first of all, we think that kids should be able to have chocolate for Easter. And we think that working moms should be able to buy a rotisserie chicken instead of having to make one from scratch. And it takes time and it makes your life easier when you're allowed to buy those things. So why are we telling people that they can't?
Interesting. And then there's this controversial measure that you mentioned that would include it would require hospitals that get public money to ask patients about their immigration status, essentially, which means kind of a lot right now, given the broader immigration context in the country. It's kind of crossing this invisible line that we've had for a mm-hmm. long time.
Yeah, and that alone obviously doesn't save the state any money. Republicans are saying it's just purely for information gathering purposes. We're not going to use this data to help ICE with their operations, but that's exactly what the Democrats think it will be used for.
Right.
That if we're collecting this data, there's going to be some sort of end goal from the Republicans, and presumably it's to go after undocumented immigrants. But hospitals would be asking people who come in on the patient forms about their status, and Democrats also believe that would have a chilling effect on people going in for treatment in the first place, even if they technically under the letter of the law aren't going to be using this for ICE.
Okay, so Cameron, what are the chances any of this will be signed by the governor?
Pretty low. I mean, considering that they're all pushing this as one package, I think things like the immigration bill and things like the SNAP food restrictions are just not going to fly with this governor. There's a chance that they could send it to the ballot afterwards, but mm-hmm. I don't know about that either. It seems unlikely.
So if she vetoes this, are there other ideas coming from the Democrats maybe to get those error rates in check and make sure they don't lose out on this federal funding?
Less so. It's my understanding that some people have been taken off of SNAP in the last month and a half from the Hobbs administration, but it's a little more quiet and it's not in part of this, you know, legislative package. It's more their own thing.
Okay. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a new documentary explores a more bittersweet Colorado River story.
It's a real, you know, plant trees whose shade you'll never sit in, or however that old saying goes, that kept us inspired with a lot of the people we worked with.
We'll hear one of the directors reflect on the reappearance of Glen Canyon as the Colorado River shrinks.
But first, more than 500 people have signed on to an online petition from Arizona healthcare providers. The petition is asking for a series of changes to the ways in which the Trump administration carries out immigration enforcement that impacts residents' access to and quality of medical care.
Sarah Bestie is a Valley pediatrician and started the petition. She told our co-host Mark Brody that this all started about a month ago during the height of the ICE surge in Minneapolis. She was getting ready for work one day and saw a group of more than 20 Minnesota physicians at a press conference talking about how the operation was detrimental to people's ability to get medical care there.
As many people were feeling that time, I was just, you know, overwhelmed and feeling sad and kind of like, what do I do? And so I just started by reaching out to a couple of like-minded, you know, physicians that I knew, just saying, are you guys also feeling this way? What can we do? And before long, like, that group of two or three physicians ended up being a whole WhatsApp chat group of dozens and dozens of physicians. By the next day, we had organized, like the day after this, that's after texting those friends, we had organized a Zoom where we all met to kind of organize further. And by the following day, I had drafted and written this petition to circulate around the state to physicians of any background for our elected leaders. Partially on a personal level, it was to channel my own, like, you know, how do I channel this into something positive? But I think as a whole group, we wanted to be able to do something meaningful and consequential with our platforms and with our privilege that we could do for patients.
What did you hear from physicians, both those who were supportive, and I suspect you heard from some who chose not to sign or didn't agree with what you're trying to do? I'm curious what kind of feedback you got on this.
For the most part, you know, I did hear from certain people, depending on like who were their employers or where they worked. Some people felt like they couldn't sign. But for the most part, people were pretty on board because it's not an outrageous petition. We're not asking for, you know, outlandish things. It's pretty much asking our public leaders to safeguard and keep healthcare accessible and secure. And so by and large, most physicians that we passed it along to, and it was very grassroots. I mean, it was like, you know, one person reaching out to two or three colleagues, reaching out to two or three colleagues. And now, I mean, it's about 560 people who have signed on. So overall, I think it was pretty overwhelmingly positive, the response that we got, which was encouraging.
Do you have any concerns, or have you had any concerns about sort of inserting yourself into what is a pretty politically charged issue?
I have. And at the same time, it feels very just straightforward to all of us, too. You know, this can be construed as a very hot button issue. But again, I think it just goes back to physicians trying to uphold our Hippocratic Oath, which we all take the minute that we get our white coats. And to me, I feel like I'm doing is holding fast to the values that I have as a person, but also the professional ethics that we are all given that day you get your white coat, which is to do no harm, protect patient privacy and dignity, and to treat those. And so while it feels a little bit vulnerable and a little bit intimidating because of the way that things can be misconstrued, I also have complete confidence behind the issue because I do feel like this is the right thing.
So I'm curious what kinds of experiences you've had or conversations you've had with patients, or since you're a pediatrician, maybe their families, about experiences they've had relative to dealing with immigration enforcement?
Yeah. I mean, may I also share some of the experiences from my fellows in the
group?
Sure,
yeah.
Yeah. And so I think anecdotally, doctors across the state and across the nation, you know, anecdotally, no-show rates. So a no-show rate is just, you know, someone's on the schedule, they don't show up for their visit. And, you know, some of this is speculation, but when we see higher than normal no-show rates, particularly around vulnerable populations or immigrants, you just wonder what's happening now that we're not seeing the same patient volumes that we used to have. I do work largely and pretty much, I mean, predominantly with immigrant children. And so, I mean, part of the assessment when we do our, you know, we look at growth and we look at, you know, development and all of these things, we also assess like mental health. And I had a child as young as 8 or 9, I forget exactly how old, and she was extremely anxious and just having, you know, mom was saying like she couldn't sleep, she couldn't concentrate in school. And then when we dug into it a little bit more during the visit, it was because she was scared that like her family was going to be taken or that she was going to be taken. And so, you know, that was inhibiting like her school performance, her sleep, her overall like stress and health. So those are some of the more basic ways. But I've heard from a patient who treats adults that a patient with hypertension, which is the high blood pressure, mm-hmm. that not only were they not coming to their appointments to be treated and picking up their medications, but the things that we do to prevent and address hypertension, such as like exercise, and that they didn't even feel safe to like walk in the community. So it's like the stress is increasing their hypertension and then they're not able to do anything that can really help it. Another patient, which is a child with special needs that follows up at the children's hospital and had heard that there was ice in that area. And so she wasn't going to all of her specialty appointments. And that can be like very consequential for a child with special needs. And so over and over and over again, like we do see how this is impacting like in big and in small ways, patients' access to care and even just their quality of care.
So as it relates to access to care, quality of care, things like that, making sure patients feel comfortable and safe going to their appointments, mm-hmm. what are you asking for? Like what kinds of policy changes would you like to see while keeping immigration enforcement that, you know, authorities think they need to do while also allowing for healthcare to continue?
Wonderful question. So, and that's the basis of the entire petition. Yeah. And so what we're asking for is a few things is just identification so that people actually know. So like having either, you know, a badge or some kind of uniform identification.
For immigration agents.
For immigrations, exactly. So that people know even who's there if someone else is trying to take them away. Secondly, that they would always have a judicial warrant to enter clinical spaces. That people in detention would receive access to timely and appropriate care. So what we've also seen is that many women have miscarried due to delayed care, which is a traumatizing event in and of its own, not to mention if you're detained at the moment. People with chronic diseases that are detained without their medication, so chronic kidney disease, diabetes, whatever, a problem. And then there's a measles outbreak in the detention facility in Texas right now. So is, you know, are the conditions sanitary? Is, you know, are they able to access healthcare? So that's another aspect for me and for all, I mean, everyone on the petition, but especially close to my heart, is finding any alternative to child detention. No child should ever be in a detention facility if there's community options. And so these are a few of the things that we've asked for.
Realistically, what kind of outcome do you expect from this? I mean, it seems kind of unlikely that the Trump administration is going to make radical changes mm-hmm. to what it's been doing. So I wonder, like, on a practical level, like, what do you hope to come from this?
I think, number one, greater awareness. I think even just having me on the show today, like, that's going to allow people that aren't in healthcare to know that, hey, this is an issue that we're still thinking about and affects us daily. But to answer your question, I was encouraged when I see that in small ways, other states, other cities have been introducing or passing legislation that does somewhat limit the power or the, you know, the geographic area where ICE can operate. And maybe there's something we can do in Phoenix or we can do in Arizona, just moving the needle slightly. It doesn't have to upend the whole process of what they're trying to do. But I think every state can decide where to put their children. And I think that that's one of the most consequential things, because the impact of detention on a child, even if it's for a matter of days, will affect them the rest of their life.
All right. That is Sarah Besty, a pediatrician here in the Valley. Sarah, thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger.
Arizona still faces a big housing shortage, upwards of 50,000 units by some counts, particularly when it comes to affordable housing. But our next guest organization is responsible for building tens of thousands of homes around the country and more than 1,000 here in Metro Phoenix. In 2024, Local Initiative Support Corporation, or LISC, invested more than $3 billion across the country to build 24,000 homes. Here in Phoenix, it was $128 million to create exactly 1,183 units of affordable housing. So that's how much it costs to build affordable housing. But how much more do we need and how do we get there? I spoke with LISC CEO Michael Pugh more about just how big of an investment it would take to really fill the gap. He told me their investments are just the start.
We've seen those dollars leveraged. And that leverage has amounted to more than $430 million in terms of impact there. Hmm. And then there's this incredible part that we also get to do is to provide grant funding in many cases that help to seed a project, get it up and running. And over the course of our time with the Phoenix team, we've been able to contribute more than $5.7 million in grant dollars out there as well.
Yeah. Okay. So a little investment or a big investment gets even bigger, it sounds like, in terms of economic impact. Let's break it down a little bit, though, and talk about just how much it costs to build affordable housing. Like, is it equal to, does it cost less than, you know, building luxury housing, for example, of which we've seen probably more built in the Valley, I will say?
So I think that it certainly costs less than building luxury housing, but the burden of building housing altogether has continued to be a significant issue. You know, we're faced with the fact that when we consider in Phoenix, landlords and home builders are all challenged with rising costs there.
Yeah.
On average, what we're seeing is that it's about $320,000 per unit. And that number, unfortunately, Lauren, continues to go up because when you think about the cost of goods and supplies, if you think about the insurance aspect, and there's a number of other cost embedded in there that just simply aren't getting cheaper. Of course, then have to get passed on in some way, making it ultimately less affordable, less accessible for so many residents.
Yeah. Yeah. When you talk about other barriers to affordable housing, does NIMBYism often come up, this idea of trying to find places where the communities you're trying to build in will allow affordable housing to be built?
Yeah, I think that it remains a challenge to get access to space for affordable housing and also demystifying what it means when we talk about affordable housing. Affordable housing doesn't mean that we are going to be, you know, implanting a bunch of communities where property values and the quality of housing and living will overall decline. In fact, it means the opposite, and particularly because of the approach that we take, which is we not only support housing, but we think about 9 national programs that ultimately build and support the ecosystems for communities so that small businesses can thrive, so that tax bases can improve, and ultimately supporting the local GDPs. You know, when we think about Phoenix, I think they've done some pretty incredible things, and one of them, just from an innovation standpoint, is that they've really worked on having a clean dirt program for developers and LISC managing the City of Phoenix EPA Brownsfield Revolving Loan Fund, which can be used to remediate land for community projects like affordable housing. A lot of the pre-development work is often what hinders the ability for affordable housing to get started quickly.
Pre-development work is in what we would call the red tape, right?
That's right. That's
yeah. So talk about those public-private partnerships you described. If you're looking at, you know, trying to gin up investment for affordable housing, which we all know we need, but is hard to make happen in a way that making a luxury apartment complex is not, where do you look? Like, what kinds of places are willing to invest in this kind of thing? It probably often does have to come from a nonprofit sector, right?
Well, one of the best examples that I can share with you is a recent project that we've just been a part of called La Victoria. And for this particular project, it's located at the light rail transit station. It's a great example of mixed-use development that's been created through intentional community development engagement. And it's a combination of public and private dollars. So the land was assembled by the city of Tempe. There was a leverage of List HUD Section 4 grant dollars to help with this project, leveraging tax credits on the low-income housing side, about $29 million in equity. And that was done through National Equity Fund. So the combination of our trusted affiliate partner that is a specialist in the low-income housing tax credits, the combination of the work that the LISC Phoenix team has done to help bring this project together, and working very closely with city government to be able to drive it to the finish line, resulted in a total of 104 units created. And so that's an example, in my opinion, Lauren, of how when you really work to leverage public and private dollars and have that vested interest from all parties to understand that this is also about quality, affordable living, we can really make a difference.
Yeah. So let me ask you lastly then, Michael, about what's needed here. Like, we've seen HUD face pretty significant cuts under the Trump administration. Do you need more public investment? Like, is there, I know there are a long list for Section 8 housing here in the Valley. What kinds of, you know, resources would be helpful in trying to meet this affordable housing demand we have here?
Yeah, I think that it's an excellent question. It really centers on the ongoing need for public and private partnerships. We've seen some great things come out of Phoenix plan under their city's housing plan, has really been able to help set and meet a goal of 50,000 homes that I think set as part of a goal for by 2030. And in that 5 year, for that 5 year plan, they're already on pace to exceed that goal, from what I understand. And so that doesn't happen without continuing to make sure that on the policy side, there is a strong advocacy and support. We have to continue to think about the zoning impact to make sure that quality, affordable housing is available. And then the private dollars, understanding the ecosystem between creating affordable housing and workforce development, improving tax bases, improving GDP. Those all are very much interdependent upon each other.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Michael Pugh, President and CEO of LISC, joining us. Michael, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Earlier this year, Phoenix band The Format released their first album in almost 20 years. For many fans across the country, Boycott Heaven is the first introduction to the band. But for Phoenix-raised millennials like Josh Chesler, the return of The Format is a much bigger deal.
In the time between The Format's last two albums, I finished high school, graduated from college, got married, bought a condo, held multiple real jobs, and got much worse at skateboarding. Yet listening to the band's recently released Boycott Heaven serves as a good reminder that no matter how much the world changes, plenty of things stay the same. Life may be pretty different now compared to the summer after my sophomore year of high school when Dog Problems released, but the monsoon season of 2006 also doesn't feel that far in the past. And just as Sam Means and Nate Roos weren't trying to perfectly recreate either of their first two albums on Boycott Heaven, we can all try to evolve and push ourselves in a new direction, without losing the things that brought us success and made us who we are in the first place. Maybe that's too deep of a message to take away from a poppy indie rock album put out by two songwriters more than a quarter century into their careers, but it also feels like an appropriate reflection on the millennial experience. As alternative-leaning Phoenix teenagers in the 2000s, we watched The Format go from a beloved homegrown band playing small local venues to opening tours with the biggest names of the era, like Taking Back Sunday, The All-American Rejects, and Dashboard Confessional. Much like Jimmy Eat World and the Gin Blossoms before them had done for prior generations of aspiring Arizona musicians, Sam and Nate showed us that a couple of kids from the Valley could make it on the national level. And of course, right when they were all set to take things to the next level, everything came to an abrupt halt. The format disbanding was the musical equivalent of the 2008 economic crash, both hitting Arizona millennials just as we were all supposed to be figuring out the beginnings of adulthood. Roos went on to great commercial success with the band Fun, Means became a band merch mogul with Hello Merch, and the rest of us fans tackled our 20s, looking back fondly on the years when the format were our band. Even the format's planned 2020 return fell into the COVID pit, the same way so many millennials were thrown off of our plans of becoming a responsible adult by locking down, losing jobs, and living through our umpteenth once-in-a-lifetime tragedy. Instead, we settled for the contactless delivery of the reissues and re-releases of the nostalgic albums from our youth. At least we did until last fall when the format returned and announced Boycott Heaven. Maybe Boycott Heaven isn't really an album about Arizona millennials rapidly approaching middle age in an increasingly challenging world. Maybe it's not our old friends Sam and Nate showing us that if two regular guys can reunite to sell out the Coliseum and headline major venues across America, that we too can reach new heights in our 30s and 40s. But maybe it should be.
Josh Chesler is a writer and musician now based in Southern California. Good morning. You are listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. We've been hearing a lot about the Colorado River lately, as Western leaders failed yet again to meet a consequential deadline to come to a deal about who will take less water from the drying river. But next here on the show, let's take a few minutes to hear another kind of story about the mighty Colorado. This one with something of a silver lining. As the Colorado River shrinks, it's revealing an iconic canyon that's been underwater for decades since it was dammed up in the 1960s, Glen Canyon. A new documentary being screened tonight in Phoenix tells its story.
I went down into Glen Canyon thinking we were all screwed. I came away actually being hopeful.
It's pretty remarkable, the rate of restoration that we're seeing.
Glen Canyon was a symbol of paradise lost, and to actually see that paradise coming back is incredible.
Diego Riley co-produced and co-directed the film alongside Will Buckley. I spoke with him more about it and why he wanted to make the film to begin with.
Yeah, there was something that felt very fated about the way that it all came together. I spent a good chunk of my childhood in Southwest Colorado on rivers, skiing, and kind of grew up around this mythology of Glen Canyon. But there's so many things that are going for this story. I mean, visually, there's few places more stunning that I've ever seen in my life. There's this added layer of meaning to that beauty, given the fact that this was underwater for 60 years. Yeah. And that's just drenched in a certain kind of poetry that's ripe for a film.
So let me back you up and talk about the history of this a little bit, because you document it in the film so well. But take us back for a moment, Diego, to the time when this dam was built and why. Like, this was not the only dam being built in the West at the time, and it was sort of almost a manifest destiny thing going on with people trying to tame the West.
Definitely. I think that we make the case for that in the film, that Glen Canyon was lost as much as anything to a certain kind of mindset. And it was a mindset that characterized so much of the overdevelopment of the 20th century. There was the obvious need for hydropower. There was this rapid expansion throughout the West. There's the Colorado River Compact that was drawn up in 1922, and the legal obligations between the Upper Basin, Lower Basin, and Mexico, water entitlements, and, you know, all of the engineering of the dam and the building of the dam itself were based on a very different pre-climate change mentality, a post-war war on nature mentality of how can we use this river and maximize its use for the expansion of the West. It came from a hubristic mindset, and ultimately there were oversights both in the dam's construction and in its engineering. And those are very real issues that we're living with today.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about what happened when the river was dammed up through Glen Canyon. I mean, there were people who had lived there. There were, you know, animals in the, it's like the water rose so fast that it couldn't even be documented fast enough, right?
Definitely. As I mentioned before, the mindset that Glen Canyon Dam emerged from was one of looking at the river as nothing more than a resource for development and for use. The angle that we wanted to take with the film was to, between river runners, native voices, environmentalists, historians, tell a story of this river to where it emerges as a character, a conversation around what rights a river has unto itself beyond the use that we have for it.
And
you hear a lot of these perspectives in the film. You hear about how just how devastating the environmental loss was. On one hand, it became known as the place that no one knew. And as it was being flooded, it was the first time that a generation of environmentalists really went in to see it, because it was just so remote. And it's been rightfully mourned as the loss of the biological heart of the Colorado River system, some of the most stunning riparian ecosystem in the United States. But the truth is also that this was a place that people had known for thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
And the archaeologists that went in to Glen Canyon to document whatever archaeological findings were about to be put under hundreds of feet of water literally could not write down their findings fast enough before the water rose.
Wow. Yeah.
A urban density of human presence over thousands and thousands of years.
So what's it been like to go back and see this canyon emerge and kind of see it through the eyes of the people that you interviewed in this film who are so closely tied to the river and to this canyon in particular? Like, it's a little bit bittersweet, right? Like, the reason the canyon is reemerging is because the river's drying up and because of climate change and all of these tough environmental realities. But it's pretty beautiful to see, it seems.
Definitely. I mean, there's a paradox at the heart of this. It was a dream on one hand. I mean, talking about what drew us, my co-director Will and I, to making the film initially, on the most basic level, it was just the chance to hang out in Glen Canyon, which was a place that we heard about and thought throughout our lives we were never going to have the chance to see.
Right.
So there's something about it that is really deeply, it's almost a deep relief being there, in the sense that so many of the climate change stories that we hear about are doom and gloom, unsalvageable. And this is a story of really nature's power to restore itself when it's given a chance.
Is there a moment in the filming of this, a place, an animal, you know, a shot that really stands out to you that encapsulated this kind of beauty of this place?
My goodness, there were so many. I mean, the beauty of the place in part, and also just the beauty of the community that we stepped into of river runners and environmentalists and people who have really dedicated their lives to seeing this canyon restored. It's a real, you know, plant trees whose shade you'll never sit in, or however that old saying goes, that kept us inspired with a lot of the people we worked with. In terms of a place, we spent the night in Cathedral in the Desert a couple times, and that was something that I never thought that I would have the chance to do in my life. A lot of people that documented, we talk a great deal about Katie Lee in the film, who became Glen Canyon's champion after its flooding.
Yeah.
Tad Nichols was someone that documented it really well, and he has the most stunning photography of Cathedral in the Desert, where you see people in the distance looking like ants in the scope of massive canyon walls. And I think that was probably talking about how I first came across Glen Canyon, seeing Cathedral specifically, and just how surreal it felt to not only to be there, but also to be capturing it, knowing that because it had been underwater for so long, so few people alive have seen it at this point. Something so special about getting to reintroduce the world to Glen Canyon.
I want to go there. That is Diego Riley, the co-director and co-producer of the short documentary, What the River Knows, joining us. Diego, thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for telling us about this. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Lauren. Yeah, absolutely.
I know of a canyon where the golden towers rise, but the only way to see it is to slowly close close your eyes.
You can see photos of Glen Canyon's cathedral in the desert on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. And you are listening here to folk singer Katie Lee, who Diego just mentioned there, singing her love song to Glen Canyon.
Down the chocolate river, floating with the tide.
All right, that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's a good read. It's called Radioheads at theshow.kjzz.org. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @KJZZTheShow.
The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning.
You've been listening to the show's podcast. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @KJZZTheShow.